news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show, and we've got all sorts of sounds and songs and stories for you today. We'll hear from Taina Asili, the Latin performer who is playing tonight in Troy at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Most of the show will be broadcast on WGXC as well through a simulcast from WOOC, the Sanctuary's station up there. We'll also hear about hunger and attempts in Albany to end it in the state budget. We'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news and after Jason Martin from Troy has finished singing this song on WGXC's Morning Show at 90.7 FM.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You're listening to WGXC Acre, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM. We're here for you.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Dan and Mary Udell of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Friday, April 21st. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Mel Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that the West Coast hotel chain Casada Group wants to open their first East Coast hotel in Hudson. The company bought the Terry Gillett Mansion at 601 Union Street for $3 million and is asking the Historic Preservation Commission permission to turn the property into a 40-room hotel. They also want to include a restaurant, bar, swimming pool, spa, and event space. Carolyn Schneider, co-founder of Casada Group, said, quote, "Hudson felt right at home with our other properties. Casada seeks properties in special locations, and we focus on architecturally unique or historic properties. For this reason, the Hudson Valley was exciting to us, with the beauty of the city and the buildings and its arts community. Our properties are typically in leisure markets in close proximity to larger cities, and so this was naturally a draw for us as well," unquote. There is no timeline yet for when the hotel could open. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Ryan Whalen reports for New York State of Politics that New York State's Independent Redistricting Commission released yet another proposed assembly map for the state legislature to approve on April 20th. Last year, the bipartisan commission could not agree on a map and instead sent two different maps of state Senate, Assembly, and Congressional lines, which the legislature rejected. Then Albany lawmakers drew their own maps of their own districts. Voters used those maps for the 2022 elections. Now the legislature is considering changing all that for the 2024 elections. Republican Assembly Minority Leader Will Barkley thinks the new map will be approved by the Democratic-led legislature. He said, quote, "I'm happy this is done and I suspect this thing will get passed next week," unquote. But the new map is almost identical to the one the legislators made. New York Public Interest Research Group Executive Director Blair Horner said, quote, "It does raise the question, though, how independent is the Redistricting Commission if they come up with maps that more or less match the ones made by lawmakers," unquote. If the map is not approved by the legislature or the governor, the commission will have until June 16th to create yet another one. And if that's struck down, lawmakers draw yet another map. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Jamel Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that the Hudson City School District Board of Education wants voters to approve a budget of $54,509,530 with no tax increase for the 2023-2024 school year. On April 18th, the board decided on that proposed budget with a 6% spending increase. The story does not say what the schools are proposing to cut and add in this year's budget. Voters decide on the fate of the budget May 16th, with polls open from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Hudson Central Fire Station, Greenport Community Center, and the A.B. Shaw Firehouse. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. H. Rose Schneider reports in the Times Union that Norfolk Southern construction on a rail line in Albany County begins April 24th, with a series of railroad crossings in Voorheesville, Altamont, Knox, and Duanesburg closed to through traffic at times through May 19th. While the Norfolk Southern Railroad replaces railroad crossings and installs new tracks, the intersections in the following towns will be closed beginning at 6 a.m. on these days. April 24th through 26th, the School Road in Voorheesville and Hennessy Road in Gilderland. May 1st through 3rd, Meadowdale and Gardner Roads in Gilderland. May 2nd through 4th, Brandel Road in Gilderland. May 2nd through 5th, Altamont Fairgrounds Back Driveway. May 8th through 10th, the Main Street in Altamont. May 15th through 17th, Bosie Hollow Road in Knox and the Schoharie Turnpike in Duanesburg. And May 16th through 19th, Cole Road in Duanesburg. You can read more about this story in the Times Union. You can read about any of these stories on the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, April 21st. Local early morning temperatures range from 43 degrees in Medusa to 51 in Tannersville. Regional average soil temperature is 50 degrees. A high of 76 at 4 p.m. coupled with a bright day will make conditions warm despite the steady 10 mile per hour winds. It should feel pretty nice, so don't forget to protect yourself from the sun, as you may not feel it as much as normal. Tomorrow, not to worry, the clouds move in overnight, keeping temperatures from dropping below 50 degrees. Then, tomorrow will be mild, if moist, with rain showing up in the afternoon, after a high of 70 degrees happens at 2 p.m. Overnight, rain picks up and keeps on going. We see a low of 53 degrees. Sunday, more rain, high of 60 degrees. Overnight, the combination of lows in the 40s and more expected rain could be dangerous for people exposed outside for a length of time. Monday, a high of 55, still looking wet, but that might change by the time it shows up. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:26 a.m., low tide at 11:15 a.m. High again at 4:55 p.m. and low again at 11:18 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 52 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 7:27 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:02 a.m. Looking way up, we see the coronal mass ejection didn't hit us yesterday, so either its trajectory was miscalculated or it's late. If it does hit, it's not going to cause too much of a disturbance. A solar tornado was captured lifting off of the surface of the sun by the Solar Dynamics Observatory. Find video of it on spaceweather.com or on the Better Weather Telegram channel. Solar wind speed is currently 379 kilometers per second at 5.9 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2.6, quiet. The current sunspot number is 97. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
Here is music from Michelle Natichello, who sometimes resides in Hudson. Brand new 2022 music. It's called Virgo.
They're calling me back to the stars, la la, deep outer space. Back to the stars.
to the stars, the outer space.
'23 new music from Michelle Nadicello, sometimes from Hudson. The song's called Virgo.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is about protecting women's sports now and into the future, and we anticipate this will be passed today, and it is a winning issue across America, standing up for the future of women and girls.
New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik joined her GOP colleagues in support of the Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act, which bans transgender women from competing in women and girls' sports. Though the bill passed by a vote of 219 to 203 in the House of Representatives, it has little chance of passing in the U.S. Senate. Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy said cisgender women athletes have lost opportunities because they were forced to compete against transgender women. Some Democrats said the measure is a way for a group they call extremist Republicans to encroach on the freedoms of everyday Americans. But a 2022 NPR Ipsos poll found two-thirds of Americans oppose letting transgender women and girls compete on teams that align with their gender identity. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said the bill is the GOP bullying transgender kids.
For me, this is not about politics. This is about being there for all of America's children, including transgender children, who just want to be able to live and to belong and to make friends.
The North Dakota legislature passed a bill to implement a near total ban on abortion with narrow exceptions for cases of rape and incest. While Governor Doug Burgum could veto, the bill passed both houses with veto-proof majorities, meaning it will most likely become law. Sponsors of the bill say it reinforces North Dakota's status as a pro-life state, but Amy Jacobson with the group Prairie Action ND countered it does not align with voters' views, since they opposed a constitutional abortion ban in 2014. She notes the six-week cutoff is before most women know they're pregnant.
Not being able to terminate that pregnancy re-victimizes them again, and it is shameful that the North Dakota legislature would not do more for these victims.
National Reading Week kicks off with Right to Read Day April 24th. The American Library Association reported demands to censor certain books hit a record high in 2022, nearly doubling the previous year. Most of the books in question deal with race or gender issues. The South Dakota legislature attempted to pass legislation prohibiting library materials considered obscene, though this measure failed. Daniel Berniston with the Vermilion Public Library says households have to make the decisions about what to read on their own.
You should help your children select reading materials that, as a parent, fit with your family's beliefs. But that does not mean, by extension, we should necessarily be telling another family or another parent what is right or wrong for their children.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. While other states attempt to curb access to voting, the state of Washington moved last week to expand access and enhance its Washington Voting Rights Act. April 13th, Governor Jay Inslee signed HB 1048, which further empowers voters and improves enforcement mechanisms in the 2018 Washington Voting Rights Act. The WVRA was passed to counteract the erosion of the Federal Voting Rights Act provisions struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. HB 1048 directs the state court to lean toward protecting voters. Quote, state and local laws related to the right to vote must be construed liberally in favor of protecting the right to vote and ensuring that all voters have equitable access to register and participate in elections. The bill also further defines who can sue if voting rights are violated and confirms the right of a Native American tribe to sue on behalf of its members. Two other bills await the governor's signature. SB 5112 strengthens Washington's automatic voter registration system with several housekeeping changes and improves noticing by mail of changes or issues. SB 5208 expands identification options for online voter registration to include the last 4 digits of a Social Security number or an ID issued by one of Washington's tribal nations. We have links to the bills and groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. Follow us on Facebook at American Democracy Minute. I'm Brian Beal.
Here is 2022 music from Lucretia Dalt. This is an album that is a soundtrack. It's called The Seed, to a movie by Lucretia Dalt. This track, Leonid's Temple, features a tape loop by Aaron Dillaway. Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined by Jessica Pino Goodspeed, who is with Hunger Solutions. She's the school meals policy and engagement manager. We've had Hunger Solutions on a number of times. I believe we had covered the fact that the One House budget resolutions from the state Senate and the state assembly had supported the idea of $280 million in funding for universal school meals. That has not yet been agreed by the governor. So, you know, Jessica, do you want to give people a brief, you know, overview of what is Hunger Solutions and, you know, what are you looking for, you know, in resolving the state budget ever gets done in terms of hunger, but particularly school meals?
Right. So I thank you so much for having me. I'm from Hunger Solutions New York. We're a statewide anti-hunger organization. Our mission is really to expand access and participation in the federal nutrition assistance programs. My program area, as you mentioned, is school meals, and we're leading this campaign with Community Food Advocates, our partners in New York City, to push for the establishment of a permanent statewide free school meals for all program. So really, as budget negotiations continue, this remains a bipartisan priority with significant support in the legislature and across a lot of community-based organizations. So we're excited and hopeful as this process continues.
Now, I'll disclose that, you know, I used to work for the Hunger Action Network of New York State. And, you know, I think probably about 1985, 86, you know, we began calling for universal school meals. Still haven't apparently quite got that yet. So maybe talk a little bit about why is universal school meals important and, you know, particularly a lot of federal, you know, funding that was, you know, put in place during the COVID crisis, and that tends to be phasing out. You know, how does that impact upon this issue?
So if any silver lining really from the COVID response is that we were able to see universal school meals in action over the last 2 years. So when the pandemic started and then the subsequent 2 years, meals were free for every student across the state. When those waivers expired, over 726,000 kids lost access to free school meals. And really, we were able to see, really, this was the most effective way to get school-aged children the nutrition they needed. These institutions and these programs are in place in every community. So this infrastructure is there as a way to really expedite food, many times nutritious food, local food, to families and to children, especially in need. So we saw it work well in the pandemic. And then as a result, states across the nation are taking this policy and really running with it. We've been fighting at the federal level to get this done, and it's really hasn't been successful yet. So states have been taking it upon themselves. We've seen California and Maine be the first ones to pass, and then quickly after, New Mexico, Colorado, Minnesota. Those are some states with permanent policies. Even surrounding us, Vermont, Connecticut, Massachusetts have all taken action and taken state dollars to make their programs whole, to offer universal meal programs in these states.
Now, the fact that you actually got the $280 million included in both the Senate and the Assembly One House budget resolution is a, you know, very positive sign, actually. What is the, if any, what has the governor been saying, you know, since the Assembly and Senate put this on the table as part of the negotiations on this much delayed state budget?
I think that's a great question, and a question that a lot of us have. You know, she in the governor's office is really the last person to really come to the table to make a stance on this. We did propose it as a coalition. We are a coalition now of over 280 organizations across the state calling for this policy from every corner, from agriculture to labor to anti-hunger groups, obviously. We did bring this to the governor's office in the summer, you know, knowing that there was broad support and, you know, it wasn't included in her executive budget. She does talk about making New York more affordable for families. This is a concrete way to do that. And so while we haven't heard her say that she supports this policy, it very much is in line with what she visions for her budget. So we're hopeful that she recognizes that and can come to the table with the legislature.
Now, not to, divert action, But you mentioned you've been trying to get, you know, the federal government, you know, because, you know, this is, I guess, primarily a federal program, you know, to support action. Has, you know, Senator Schumer, as the Senate Majority Leader, has, you know, he put his weight behind his proposal? Or Senator Gillibrand, who's been good on hunger in the past?
So I think, but we are very lucky in New York to have some champions, and especially Senator Schumer in his leadership position, fought hard for these extensions of waivers each time. However, where we really stalled out and where we saw the possibility of this being covered fully by the federal government was in the Build Back Better Act. That bill never saw, never was passed. And, you know, we continue to see it come up in Biden's budget even, but just the climate right now in Washington, for anything to pass the House, you know, since, you know, we're, as an anti-hunger organization and also anti-hunger groups across the nation, we're really kind of in a mode now shifting to defense and protecting our programs versus looking at expansion, unfortunately. So really, we know that kids can't wait, and there's politics happening in Washington, and we can't play politics with kids who are experiencing hunger. We know the current system in place, kids slip through the cracks. We're not meeting the needs of some of the kids who need it most. And this is really the most effective way to do that. So again, you know, not seeing this at the federal level, even though we have great leadership from New York, unfortunately, the politics in Washington make this really difficult.
Now, you mentioned that we did have universal school meals for a couple of years due to COVID. You know, what was some of the positive impacts that, you know, maybe both documented, you know, by this pilot, but, you know, also previously shown in terms of impact upon students and children, you know, when they have access to universal school meals?
Absolutely. So we saw the impact throughout the pandemic, but even before the pandemic, there are federal provisions that are in place that allow our highest poverty schools to offer free meals to all kids. That's through the Community Eligibility Provision, or CEP is what we call it for short. So these programs are already in place in some of our largest districts in New York State. So our Big Five, New York City, Rochester, Buffalo, Albany, Syracuse, and many of our larger urban districts already have universal school meals through this provision, CEP. And that has also given us almost 10 years of data and research to look at how this really levels the playing fields for all kids. We know that community eligibility schools, the children who attend those schools are three times less likely to experience food insecurity. It really eliminates that stigma around free school meals being tied to income, which is a significant barrier to appropriation. As long as we're charging for school meals, there's going to be that stigma, and there's going to be kids who are hungry choosing not to eat because there's that stigma attached to the program. So as long as we're charging for that service, that stigma will exist. We're able to get rid of that in CEP schools. But some beyond kind of this, the stigma and the hunger, we know that it estimates to about $140 in grocery savings per month for a family. Also really create some equity around health, education. We know that kids are getting their healthiest meals at schools. They're getting consuming more milk and vegetables and fiber versus what they may be bringing to school. We know that it affects test scores, attendance, behaviors. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to school districts who have implemented a lot of interventions to improve attendance, improve behavior, and the simple change of offering free meals to all kids has allowed them to tackle that just by feeding the kids. Feed them and they will come has really been a result of community eligibility in many schools. But there are many, many impacts of offering free school meals in terms of health, education, and even equity.
We've been talking to Jessica Pino Goodspell of Hunger Solutions. Jessica, if people want more information, how can they do that? If they want to express their opinion, is there a quick way to do that to either legislators or the governor in 15 seconds?
Sure. We have a website, schoolmealsforallny.org is our campaign website. You can learn there about the policy, about the great impacts of research, but also there are some ways that you can get involved if that interests you, and on our take action page. Thanks so much for having me today.
thank you. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
This Friday, April 21st, Taina Asili will be performing at the Sanctuary for Independent Media as a part of the Rooted in Independent Media Growing Toward a Just Future Celebration Weekend. She joins me, Tria Love, now. So welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Something I noticed about your music is that you really instill all of your music with your values and beliefs. So how, in your creative process, how do you manage to kind of stick to those values?
Well, you know, I think that I have had to find creative ways to share my work with the world that are maybe outside of the mainstream. And spaces like the Sanctuary for Independent Media have been an integral part of that. You know, all these spaces that make room for artists of the margins, artists that are speaking to these issues. So that's been an important piece. And through that, I try to kind of allow my authentic voice to flow. So, my music sort of ranges musically in terms of my musical interests. You know, I love reggae and rock and all different forms of music, you know, Afrobeat to reggaeton, all of that juicy stuff. And I just let my heart, my love and liberation sort of leanings direct what musical rhythms need to come forth.
When the pandemic first hit, a lot of people were really looking inward. But it seems like throughout that period, you really managed to stick to a positive message. And so what was it that kept you going and kept you able to keep that positive message?
You know, I think like everybody else, I went through deep depression and turmoil and severe anxiety. My practices, my self-love and self-care practices really shot to the forefront. So those looked like nourishing my body with good food, movement, leaning into my family that I lived with. Luckily, I wasn't physically alone, but had, you know, family to lean on, helping, feeling a sense of community, even though I was alone. And so that was pretty integral to me being able to start to slowly articulate what I wanted to share from it. That said, we were in a place of urgency, right? And so my messages, I'm not sure if they were necessarily positive, but they were certainly proactive, because it was like, we're in a state of emergency and we have things we need to do. I was grateful that being known as an artist that's focused on liberation themes and working with that urgency, people called upon me to be able to speak out on different things. So I was able to work with different organizations like 1 Billion Rising and the Women's March and the Poor People's Campaign, as Movement for Black Lives, finding ways to support the movements that were really coming to the surface as being needed, you know, even more during the pandemic. So I heeded that call, you know, and did what I had to do and offered what I could offer. And that also helped me. Though I was feeling that depression and anxiety, I also knew my family and my community needs me to be present and show up. And so it was balancing that self-care and that gentleness and that quiet and that reflection with staying proactive and doing what I could do, you know.
So I think that your music also has a lot of spirituality to it. How do you define your spirit? And is that something that, you know, helped in this time of emergency?
Yeah, it's not like a singular target, but really sort of like a moving space that I live in terms of understanding spirituality throughout my life. I, in terms of spiritual practices, I practice Ifa, which is an African spiritual tradition, religion. I also have been very much inspired by the Nipponzen Myohoji order, specifically at the Grafton Peace Pagoda, and inspired by their Buddhist teachings. I also, you know, grew up in a Christian family and was inspired by that. Indigenous teachings that I've learned. So all these different pieces and threads have influenced my spiritual understanding, and I think is still unfolding for me. But I think that all those threads are woven into my music.
How does your relationship with your ancestors manifest? What does that look like?
Well, I do pray to my ancestors regularly, and I have a more structured spiritual practice to pray with them. But they're folded into my music. You know, I carry them with me in the music that I make. You know, so my mother and father are both lovers of Afro-folkloric musical traditions of Puerto Rico. My grandmother, Abuelita Gloria, was a really incredible poet. I consider it part of our almost our Taino heritage, these arreitos, these poetry prayers, you know, praying in these beautiful, poetic, powerful ways. Also, she would just like write down poetry and share it in a card or in a piece of paper she'd slip to you. My grandmother was a beautiful singer. And, you know, all of that is, I carry them with me. They literally live inside my body, you know, at a very cellular level. They are present with me. They're present in my voice. They're present in my music. And they continue to teach me, you know, as I create, I'm learning from them. I'm learning through them. And also I see them in my children. My parents passed away pretty early. So whereas some people might have more distant connection to ancestors, my ancestors are most, you know, I'm most connected to the ancestors that I knew pretty recently that transitioned to the realm of the ancestors early in their lives. And so I'm able to speak to my children about their ancestors in really fun and joyful ways. And I see them. I see my ancestors in them. Yeah, it makes me so happy.
Yeah, I guess I'm really, because I feel sometimes like in the Christian faith, people can be very unwavering in their attitude about it. So how do you balance the growing up in a Christian family with other aspects of spirituality?
Mm. You know, my father's mother was, I think she was Presbyterian. My mother's mother was Catholic, and they were both deeply connected to the church. My parents also understood African lineage of religion, right, that can extends into Ifa, so Santeria. And they shared these things with me, but allowed me to just unfold in my own way, in my own understanding. They were very respectful of not pressuring me to follow their path because we had that understanding of spirituality, even if it was from different perspectives. You know, I loved praying with my grandmothers. One of our points of connection is actually our worship of the earth, you know, of God that lives in all of the life on this planet. And they were beautiful worshipers of, you know, plant life, animal life, you know, trees, wind, sun. They really taught me to see God in all things. And that stayed with me too. So, you know, I didn't grow up with that super, super pressure to follow any specific religious path. And that's also how I raise my children too, you know.
Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about rebellion in your music. And I just kind of wanted to get a definition of how rebellion is important to you.
I grew up in a town where there weren't a lot of people of color, where queer identity was really suppressed. And I found punk rock specifically as a way for me to rebel against that sexism, racism, and homophobia that I was experiencing growing up, and to speak my truth to power. And so that was where I started to kind of interact with this feeling of rebellion. And punk rock moved me into all different types of forms of activism, almost all of which I'm still a part of today. Work around gender justice to freeing political prisoners and ending mass incarceration, climate justice, animal liberation, all these things. I started with that punk rock rebellion. The oppressive systems that we were just taught to be the norm, to be what is. And really just being able to shake that up and to say, maybe we need to dream of something else. And so punk rock became that place for me where we had collectives and we had communal kitchens and we ran Funa bombs and we organized our own shows and we had our own record labels. And we started to dream up what a world outside of capitalism could look like.
That was Taina Asili speaking with me, Tria Love, for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And you can see her perform on April 21st, along with El Hu Ture. And on April 22nd, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Will hold a talk and discussion at the Sanctuary. Tickets and more information can be found at mediasanctuary.org.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. La lluvia cae, el río nos guía. La lluvia cae, el río nos guía. La lluvia cae, el río nos guía.
was Resiliencia from Albany, New York, singer-songwriter Tanya Asili from her 2019 album of the same title.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Andrea Mako reports in Porcupine Soup, the Greenville Central School District Board of Education will hold a forum May 30th to let parents vent about what books they want banned from the school library. A few parents have been wanting to ban books in the school library, including All the Boys Aren't Blue, a memoir by George M. Johnson about growing up as a queer black kid in New Jersey. But Kelly Wolf told the school board, and I quote, "This is not just two or three books. There are like 30 or 40. I have been doing my research and will get you a final count," end quote. Wolf did not say if she has read those 40 books. Greenville Superintendent of Schools Michael Bennett said, and I quote, "As educators, it is not our responsibility to ban books, but to offer books that represent viewpoints to which students need to be introduced," end quote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Andrea Mako in Porcupine Soup reports that Representative Mark Molinaro announced many community development and improvement projects in his 19th congressional district that he submitted to the House Committee on Appropriations. This is what is sometimes called pork in Washington, D.C. Each congressional representative may request funding for up to 15 projects each fiscal year. Not all projects are guaranteed funding, but most get their dollars under the guidelines issued by the Appropriations Committee. Locally, Molinaro asked for $2.4 million for the Village of Athens to rehabilitate its wastewater plant and another $2.4 million for Greene County Highway and Solid Waste Department to improve Main Street in Lee. Read the full story in Porcupine Soup. Liz Montgomery reports for Porcupine Soup that the bridge over 10 Mile Creek on Route 81 in Durham will be closed and replaced for the next 9 weeks. Until June 23rd, that means a detour to State Route 145. But Oak Hill business owners are complaining about the detour. Mary Lou Nahas, owner of IU Trip Antiques and Home Provisions, says, and I quote, "There are signs about the detour on Highway 81, but they make no mention of Oak Hill. It is like Oak Hill does not exist," end quote. She wants more signs as other businesses in Oak Hill have reported fewer customers since the work began. Naha said, and I quote, "If you know the back roads, you know how to get to Oak Hill. But if not, you do not know what to do. Since the businesses in Oak Hill derive much of their business from people coming from outside the community, this lack of direction hurts them," end quote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Mid-Hudson News reports that Metro North Railroad now has its highest number of riders since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, but the rail line is only at 74% of their pre-pandemic average of riders. To try to get those numbers up, Metro North is now offering a 10% discount for monthly passes and a 20% off 20-trip ticket tailored for a hybrid work schedule. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Voter turnout in the U.S. is low by international standards, even lower in rural America. In presidential elections, about a third of rural counties have lower voter turnout than the national average. A lack of civic infrastructure, such as libraries, public gathering places, or access to broadband plays a big role, according to research by Population Health Institute.
So if that space isn't there, you're more likely to not participate, and voter turnout is one thing. They also measured census participation or volunteering. Those things also decrease.
Daily Yonder data reporter Sarah Malott says race, class, education, and voting restrictions also affect turnout. She cites Colorado, which has universal mail-in voting and high rural turnout, compared to the Deep South, where voting barriers are rampant.
There's some rural counties, particularly in a black belt of the American South, that have really low voter turnout.
Typical investors are unlikely to fund rural communities' most essential needs, like childcare, grocery stores, or a local mechanic. But impact investing does, helping areas historically left behind by philanthropists and Wall Street. Anya Slepian explains.
Instead of prioritizing financial returns, impact investors put community needs first. Andrew Crossan is the CEO of Invest Appalachia. He says socially minded funding can be especially important for rural communities who have not always benefited from traditional investment.
A lot of investment into rural places has been extractive, but it's a tool, and so we can use investment for good as well.
Organizations like Invest Appalachia fill a large gap in rural funding. At last count, despite having roughly 20% of the U.S. population in 2010, only 7% of national grants went to rural organizations. And Appalachian residents received just one-tenth of the national average of philanthropic dollars.
Money follows money. And so we're trying to break that cycle of no money flowing historically.
I'm Anya Slepian.
The public has until June 20th to comment on a proposed rule change by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. If approved for the first time, it would allow the agency to lease parcels of public land for conservation. Pamela Flick, Defenders of Wildlife.
For nearly 40 years, the agency has largely focused on resource extraction and other multiple uses, but neglected managing public lands for ecosystem health and wildlife.
Opponents say adding conservation leases is beyond the scope of current laws governing public lands. Flick disagrees.
This rulemaking gives the BLM an opportunity to rebalance its priorities.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
And now here is your WDXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Friday, it will be sunny with a high near 77 degrees. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 50 degrees. And on Saturday, a slight chance of showers after 2 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 67 degrees. And Saturday night, showers are likely, then showers and possibly a thunderstorm after 11 p.m. with a temperature low of around 51 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.